Right, well, welcome to another recording podcast from www.spirituality.org.za. This is Dr. Dion Foster, and it's my joy to bring you a recorded lecture from Professor Martin Przeski, a retired professor of ethics from the University of KwaZulu-Natal. This particular lecture was delivered on the 22nd of June 2009, to the Joint Academic Societies Conference on Religion and Theology at Stellenbosch University. And the title of the lecture is, Does the Secular State Contribute Towards the Moral Decline of South African Society? It really is a very interesting lecture with many wonderful and insightful points, theological, ethical, and philosophical, and I'd encourage you to listen to it. Just to mention that the sound quality is a little bit iffy in some points. I recorded it on my MacBook just with the internal mic and haven't had much time to edit it. And so if you hear chairs moving and you hear me typing throughout, please just ignore that. I would encourage you to listen to the lecture as you can. And just to ask, if you do use it in any way or share it on any platform, could you please reference Professor Przeski, Martin Przeski, and if you could also make reference to my website, www.spirituality.org.za. Well, the lecture is up next, and I'd love to hear your feedback and comments. You can send me an email at digitaldion@gmail.com, or you are welcome to add a comment on my website, particularly in the blog section, www.spirituality.org.za/blogger with two G's, blogger.html, and I'd love to hear from you. Here is the lecture.
This presentation is trying to unpack the title of it, which is that, and that is the secular state playing for the moral problems in our country? And I want to go into the arguments of those who said yes it is, and then argue against that, and pretty much my own position. One and two here are back here from last time, and any of you who are here again, you have my sympathies or my admiration, and you really welcome to take part in the story as you would just have. May I just check that welcome? Are you here to hear about the secret state? I'm a bit of concern that the program may be changing names. Some people may be expecting something else here. All right, so what I want to do is just to orientate you is go through 5 points. We have, I think, 3 to 5 o'clock. This is something else happening.
Mm-hmm.
So I need to keep my eye on it. I think this is scheduled to go on to 5. This is it. And the next one is a tribal important one. So I have a little bit of time to get out. I need to get to the next one myself anyway.
Yeah.
I want to go through 5 points here. Firstly, briefly, very briefly, about the concerns about morality that we have in this country. May I ask, is anybody here from outside South Africa? Very big welcome to you. Some of this talk is really focused just on South African political and ethical reality, but it isn't limited to that, because the issue arises elsewhere. Then I want to look at the question of blaming the secular state, and in particular, I want to talk about that. You expressed in public 2 years ago by one of the influential religious leaders in South Africa, namely Pastor Raymond Foley, with some of the Then I want to say why those who blame the secular state are wrong, in my view. Then I want to say an important part of that, what I think the real cause of the moral problems in our country are. And then I'll give you 2 conclusions about it. Just to get one thing completely clear, the first session I became aware of, there may be some slight misunderstandings about this. When I'm talking about matters ethically, matters ethical or moral, what am I talking about? I'm talking about, fundamentally, not something you study in university. I'm talking about the living, or the intent to live out, a sense of what's right and good. And fundamentally, if you study the various ethical traditions of the world, there are 2 great clusters of values that almost One, that it is good to seek out the benefit you could do to another, whatever form it takes, friendship to your equals, compassion to those who suffer, respect all around, and so on. There are many forms of generosity, if you like, beneficence. And then secondly, and equally important, that there has to be a truthfulness about the love of truth. You cannot actually be effectively kind and generous without an accurate, truthful knowledge of that to which we wish to give some kind of gift of generosity. That's what I mean by. Now, the first section then, what I want to say is to talk very briefly about concerns about morality in South Africa, about the not doing of the right and good. There are worried voices all over. The benefit of our visitors here, who may not be familiar with this, we are hearing religious voices, we are hearing politicians, we're hearing educators, we're hearing newspaper editors. I was interested in the editorial in yesterday's Sunday, major Sunday, bigger city Sunday newspaper, which was like a tease on it about the country. We're hearing it from there, we're hearing it from the scene editors, and we're hearing it all over from concerned citizens. Those of you who are familiar with me, I used to be a professor at the University of KwaZulu-Natal for many years in religious studies. Before that, I trained in theology, Christian theology, and I moved into the world of comparative religion and then into the world of comparative applied ethics. For the last 15 years, that's where I've been. I'm now left the university and I work independently as an ethics educator, applied ethics educator, under a structure called Compass Ethics, which I began a small team of people on the country for 15 years. So that's where I'm coming from on this issue. It's fundamentally about an issue of religious ethics in this country. Now, why is there this worry? Again, those who live in South Africa don't need me to tell you this. We know that there are, alongside the glaring contradiction with the enormous structural gains we've had in this country, of a transition from public racism to non-racism, minority groups, democracy, out of very important gender legislation, many structural and legal improvements, all sorts of non-exploitation of legislation about the workplace, a whole lot of hugely important moral gains that we've had in this country. We have some absolutely awful things going wrong morally. The murder level in this country is something like 7 times as high as in the United States. 7 times as high. Now, I've lived in the United States. I always thought it was actually a really violent society. You can go to a shop and get the artillery up to the counter and things like that. A lot of homicide happening. Ours is 7 times worse. We have production problems that make us as a country, we are declining in international trustworthiness in terms of production. The business world, I do a lot of ethics work to do with the business world. And above all,
I'm sorry to interrupt you, it's just Sunday.
I'm sorry, Bernie.
Yes, so many things. Something to move a little bit because a lot of people are coming in and they're so full and they're not out.
Okay. What are we saying? You can bring us a desk, you can use the back of the roof with these four chairs. Sorry, that is fine. I mean, this has to be a source of colossal change in had in this country. There are huge concerns in the Eastern Crescent here, men and women alike. So we have things to be deeply worried about. And I think it's entirely right that we have to look, of course, and say why, now that we've got rid of the structural evils of the past, legally and otherwise, why are these things going so terribly wrong? And within that context, then, to move to my second point, I want to talk briefly about, I need to mention, and then we'll go on to analysis, those who are blaming the secular state. And the most influential voice I've come across is one of South Africa's most best-known Christian figures, Pastor Graham McCauley, whom I do not know, and he published an interview in the Sunday Times in 2006, and he may have changed his mind, but it's that view, and I've heard it elsewhere. He expressed it so clearly that I'm using his expression of it as my point of departure in looking at those who are blaming the secular state. So please understand, I have absolutely no, I'm not launching some sort of critique of Pastor Graham McCauley, but of the view that the secular state is to blame for things going wrong in this country. This is what he said. I'm quoting three bits of the interview. You can get it up Google yourself in the Sunday Times if you're interested. It's May the 14th, 2006. The biggest circulating newspaper by a long talk in this country. On the op-ed pages, right in the middle of the paper, this is what he said. First quote, "The moral fiber of our nation is suffering, it's degenerating." Well, I agree. Except, you must also remember those important advances that have come about that show that the moral barometer in some respects has risen through. Second quote, "A godless society," said the pastor, "because that's why Holland and France, being secular states, have declined dramatically in their morality." End of quote. And then thirdly, quote, "Once you become a secular state, the country becomes bankrupt." Implication, morally bankrupt.
Yeah. Martin, I didn't hear the author's name.
Pastor Ray McCauley, of the Rima Bible Church. Okay. He's one of the most influential of the new mega churches in this country. I don't want to say more about him, but that's why. As I say, it's not him personally here, but the view, Augustine that I'm talking about, but that's who it was. Now, please note, there are certain assumptions in that statement, those three statements, especially the second two, that I think are just very fundamentally mistaken. The first one is the idea that secular equals godless. Secular equals godless. I think that's just fundamentally wrong. I'll explain why later. The second one is that godless equals morally bankrupt. Godless equals morally bankrupt. Now, you cannot have had any deep experience that I certainly have of atheists or non-theist people and believe that. It's absolutely not true. I personally heard the Dalai Lama once say, we Buddhists are atheists. Now, you may not admire the old way of Tibet was run before 1959. You can't deny that we have a great moral icon in our time. I've heard him say, we Buddhists are atheists. So the idea that secular equals godless equals morality is a sequence of ideas that I think is just factually wrong. But I'm going to show why. But I want to also draw your attention to the fact that in the run-up to the 2009 election, there was a much publicized visit by our new president to Pastor McCauley's church. Not only was he there, but he actually had the photo of the lecture. That was the only thing that happened. Quite a lot of moves were made by politicians in the run-up to the election to conservative churches by the ruling party. And so the question is arising, is there a new alliance in South Africa between the post-Mekhi period and some of our conservative religions? And there are some signs that there might be. What form it might take, you don't know. But the extreme form would be constitutional change, which the ruling party alone cannot achieve, to bring South Africa, to take South Africa away from its present constitutional secularity into some sort of religiously orientated state. So that's the scene I'm talking from. The underlying issue is, what are the real causes of these horrifically bad moral degenerations that we see going on? Now, why do I think those who blame the secular state for this problem are wrong? A little very brief background. I do have a personal interest in this. In the years leading up to democracy and the 1996 constitution, I was very, very involved with the whole process of arguing for a constitutional change into a secular state. He's very much involved with that. It's interesting, in that period, the opposition to myself and others who were involved in this came very strongly from one quarter only, and that's from the more conservative part of Christianity. Liberal Christian leaders, Jewish leaders, Muslim, Hindu, African traditionalist people were pretty much in support of it, generally. Right? We were opposed then. Nonetheless, it came about with one minor loss, and that's in the preamble of the Constitution. There's a bit of a slip, but it's not judicial, so that's perhaps at least tolerable. So, please understand, I'm not just interested in this as an issue in academic ethics. It's very much part of what I have been involved with as an academic activist, and about which I have certain satisfaction, and I would not want us to lose our secular state in this. I can be convinced on grounds of ethics and logic, fact, that it is in fact a moral mistake, and one we should correct. Now, why from a, I want to talk first about what I consider to be the ethical or moral reasons for disagreeing with the kind of view that Pastor McCauley and others, including a very senior academic at one of our universities in this country and other religious figures that I'm aware of, why I think they're wrong on moral grounds. And I want to mention certain values that I think most people would regard as part of any acceptable moral list of essential moral values. And briefly show why I think the secular state does better than any alternative at respecting and furthering those values. But first, what would the alternatives to a secular state be? This is, some people think of a five-part typology. I just like to work with a three-part. Three basic positions. There are some nuances which turn it into a five-part one, nuances. The three are, on one extreme, you can have a theocracy. A country which is officially and constitutionally aligned with a particular religious tradition. You could say, nominally, England, with the Church of England, is sort of, you know, frankly, laying out way, in my view, theocracy. Some of our Islamic states would be in this category, for example. By the look of Iran, maybe still carry on in that situation. Okay. State and politics emerge into one. The law is based upon religious sources and so on. One religious tradition is dominant, or even is the sole recognized one. The Islamic Republic of Pakistan has some analogies with it. At the other extreme would be the completely anti-religious, atheistic state. Not just atheistic, anti-all religion. The best example, if you're interested, try and dig up the last constitution of the former USSR. That's a very good example of that state, avowedly, explicitly atheistic. And then the middle position, in my view, is the secular state. And why do I think it's the only one? Now, to explain that, I need to make a distinction and invite you to say what you think about it. I want to say it's extremely important to deconfuse two terms, secular and secularism. And unfortunately, in South Africa, lots of people are not making that distinction now. They are interpreting secular as secularism, and that's a very serious mistake. And I have to say, I take some responsibility. When I began campaigning on very published things, some of them in the popular press, I did explain what I meant by the secular state. But I never then explicitly said, do not confuse this with secularism. So what is secular and what is secularism? Secular simply means independent of religious control, neutral with regard to religion or non-religion. Secularistic, which is a tweak on secularism, is an ideology. It's a belief system, for example, held by Richard Dawkins. Familiar with that, Richard Dawkins, any of you? Dawkins would be a good example, but so was Karl Marx and Lenin and many others. Explicitly rejecting any reality to anything behind religion, and indeed going further to think of religion as fundamental evil. The secularism. Now, it's hugely different to advocate a secular state from a secularistic state. But those who, in important places in our country, are interpreting secular as secularism are doing it, or were doing it. Now we may have a backlash coming. Pushing religion out of the public space. The religions are worried about many things. We need to come back. Some of them are looking for a doorway back into political influence from about 70%. Christians in South Africa, for those of you who are new to South Africa, about 80% of the population,
And the growing strong part of Christianity tends to be the more conservative, newer churches, the so-called mainline, I prefer to call them old-line churches, much to the difference and so on, maybe looking for a new kind of ability in Christianity. So why would the secular state, there are some seats up here, I think one over here, why would I say the secular state is morally superior to the alternative? Well, let me think those values. The first one I'm going to take is respect. I think the secular dispensation was far better. Now, in our African cultures, in our African tradition, I live in a Zulu-speaking part, these Zulu speakers here, in the art group, something I know, but I mean by respect. The great answer to the question is, since we human beings exist in interrelationship with others, would you? The question becomes, we cannot change it, that's how it is. The ethical question is, how should we relate to others? Ubuntu, or at least in Zulu, Kronipa means respectfully, deep respect, a value and honoring of the other. Now, there may be some diminishing of its power through patriarchal structures. I acknowledge that, but nonetheless, there it is. Now, if what we're saying is, number one moral duty that we all have to one another is that one of respect, which means an honoring and a cherishing of that which is real and good in them and of them for their own sake, then surely we have to do it in a way that makes everyone first class. I think only the secular religion can do that. The other alternatives relegate some or other of our belief traditions to a second or third or even an upward position. I cannot see how that would respect them. It's my one huge quarrel with Richard Dawkins, with whom I am otherwise a quarrel of sympathy. I think anybody who lumps, you know, some of the most outrageously racist religious figures, along with people like Tutu and so on, has simply not done helpful. And that is deeply disrespectful to the people concerned. But that's another story. The second value is inclusivity. I would think it's a moral norm that where possible, we should do the good we can to everybody we affect. And only if it's absolutely impossible do we then accept some limitation on that. So majoritarian thinking, namely satisfy the majority, is as a best a second prize. The basic rule is where good can be done for everybody, we must. So the secular state clearly will fare better because it is including in its respectful treatment, it's even having freedom of religion for everybody equally. The issue of dignity. I do not see how the human dignity of a Russian Orthodox priest could have been anything but deeply damaged by the Soviet Union. And I don't see how the dignity of a John Hick in England was protected by a constitution which made it impossible for him ever to get a chair at Oxford or Cambridge because he was Presbyterian and Anglican. A law which says you may be the best applicant, but because you are not an Anglican, you can't have that job, is a faithless equivalent to racism and sexism. And then about the justice. All traditions honor justice. And in the simplest sense of fairness towards all, seems to me that there's no other way than the law of the constitution can achieve it by saying every belief system, not every act, every belief system is equally permitted and respected, and none is superior to the other. Satisfy the law of justice better than the alternatives. I was once asked by somebody, a senior law person, did I include Satanism in that? And I said, yes. Yes. If someone chooses to believe in a faith position called Satanism, much though I personally disagree with that, they're entitled to that belief as well. If they practice child sacrifice, that's another matter. That's by anyone's known. I don't say they do, but there's something we might want to talk about later. If you are into the secular state, you have to be inclusive about it with everybody. Now, that's the ethical reasons I wanted to single out, and when I began campaigning, they were very much to the fore. However, I'm aware that now in today's debate, if the critics of the secular state on moral grounds, or out of moral concern I share on some issues, I'm not one bit sympathetic of those who want us, the country, to stop forbidding same-sex marriages, because they think they have anything to care less about them. But those who worry about rape and murder and violence and corruption, I share. Now, on those issues, those who are campaigning against the secular state are not doing it because of independence. They're doing it because of religious conviction and most of them doing it on the conservative religious one, which tends to be very biblical, in my view, in a very conservative, often fundamentalist way. So, if people like me wish to have any influence on them, if somebody like me is to say persuasively to someone like Pastor McCauley, look, I think that's not the right way to do it, they have to be biblical grounds for it, because I think those are the ones that always count most. Now, I am not a biblical scholar, but I have tried empathetically to, and I've talked to theologians and other Christian scholars, and I would think there are biblical grounds that are very clear in suggesting, albeit indirectly, that the secular state should be first choice for every Christian. Here are some of them. The golden rule. Every Christian ethics people tell me again and again, if you really want to understand Christian ethics, you need to know about love, and you want to know it in more detail. It's the golden rule in Luke chapter 6, 31. Do to others as you would have them do to you. All familiar with it. Now ask, let's unpack that. What does it mean if you're living because of your biblical faith under the rule that you must do to others what you want them to do to you? If that's your rule, then let's translate that. Let's do a little mental exercise. Translate that into the constitutional secular question. So I'm talking to, let's imagine it's my late father, who was a very conservative, fundamentalist, Christian, deeply devout, and so on. A very deeply ethical man. Say to him, Dad, ask yourself now, what would you want for your family in South Africa? The answer was simple. Oh, he was long dead before this happened, so it's a picture of imagination. He would have said something like, I want those Christian values that are so central to people like me and others who are deeply Bible believing to govern our society. Because they are true and good, and they come from our Trinity to Christ and so on. So then you said, fine, now, if you're going to live by the golden rule that comes out of the highest of authorities in the Christian community, that means you must want the same for Jewish people. And so you must want the Torah to have the same status. You must want the Bhagavad Gita, or the laws of mind in Hinduism, or the Quran, or the word of the ancestors, the Amaluzi, in African traditional religion. You must want them to have the same status. You cannot want it just for your own, and not for them. And the legal term for that is a constitutionally secular situation. Not secularist, but secular. I think there's the issue from a believer's point of view of the very nature of belief. In Islam, there's a wonderful one liner, which is, there shall be no coercion in matters of faith. I couldn't find an equivalent one scripturally when I was preparing for this, but I think we can all understand belief or faith is not something that can be commanded or ordered. But when we do have a coercive context for our religion, when the state power favors a certain way of being, believing, and acting, it comes out of a religious source, there is pressure to conform to that. When I grew up, I experienced this in the old South Africa. There was an awful lot of force-fed religion. It produced hypocrisy, it produced hatred of the church, because of the compulsory chapel going, the compulsory activities that somebody didn't want to go to, you were made to go to. And if you dared stop anything like that, you were a caning. I think that is profoundly undermining of the very heart of what it means to you, and to believe in any tradition, but including Christianity. If it is free, or it is not there at all. One of my teachers when I was in theology, David Jenkins, who later became an Anglican bishop in England, David Jenkins began one of his books with the following, talking from a Christian theologian: God is either a gift or an illusion, supremely free or nothing. And I think secular states simplifies that. Freedom of operation of space, unlike the secularistic one, and unlike the people. I think the secular state creates more space for prophetic religion. My interest in the history of religion and the history of ethics centers very much on the historically colossally influential role played by the great luminary religious figures of history: Moses, the Hebrew prophets, Zoroaster in Persia, Muhammad, Jesus, Paul, and so on. And in my personal view, some of them, in my view of Christianity, is more radical as an ethical figure than as a theological figure. Much more radical. The ethical, the, the, the world has been nourished by the prophetic voice. If it almost always, however, not always, I think Marx is a prophetic voice too, in a secularistic context, but mostly out of a religious context. Now, we want to encourage that, and the more you limit freedom of operation, the more there is pressure against the prophetic voice, the more we harm the structure. That is why it was so appallingly hard for prophetic voices to come up 40, 50 years ago in places like this. I came here as a student once for a conference, and I remember being lectured to by a professor today who passionately argued for the biblical truth of a Bible. And I have friends who were students at that time who disagreed and who suffered. Because they were bucking the system. We don't want things that will silence prophetic voices. Not all of us are Baylor's Reveers or other highly courageous figures like that, where you pay a terrific price for. I wish we all were. I'm not one of them. And the harder we make it for ordinary people to take a prophetic stand, the more we damage the ethics that we need in our society. And then I want to pose a theological question, and that's not what I think is a New Testament answer. What would the perfect deity that Christians of all stripes believe in want of a constitution of a country anywhere in the world? Presumably, the most ethical one. The most inclusive, the most just, the most respectful, and so on. That's all sounds very logical and secular. So what about biblical ground? And I was looking for this, and I began to think that maybe, as I cast my mind back to the years of my biblical studies, maybe 4 decades ago, that maybe in the New Testament passage, also in Luke, I think it is, what's it, 15, about the shepherd who isn't satisfied that 99 of the 100 sheep are saved. Christians here would know this one. Goes out to the last one and is the idea of a complete inclusivity, and a divine tirelessness at the greatest inclusivity. It's not enough to satisfy 80% of the population when 100% can be treated with injustice. I would think that's perfectly trivial. So, those are my thoughts about why I think this view is wrong. Now, what is the real root of the problem according to my view? Here are some suggestions about an issue that is more complex than I could possibly deal with alone, let alone in about 10 minutes. I invite you to think about it. The country's future may well depend upon us when we're doing some really hard thinking here. And even if it means for people like me actually ending up by saying, I was wrong about the second mistake. Think that right now, but maybe. Let's be open-minded. The evils are so serious, we cannot plead to change the personal positions. We have to open this thing up as critically as possible. And that includes suffering. So I'm doing this. Here's what I think the real causes are. Is there any valid issues? The first one is the mistake of trying to analyze, look for causes in short-term and superficial ways. The way I put it earlier in my slide is to vary slightly the well-known religious proverb, you know, about the wheels of God grind slowly, but surely. By saying the moral rules also grind slowly, but surely. There isn't a magic moral one. There's no way we can just say, let there be goodness. And I don't think even the deity can do that. Let there be goodness and there's goodness. There may be life, but not goodness. It's uncommandable. Moves, but slowly. So we have to look in the long term. And in my view, that means I in this book, I'm limiting only to the start of colonial and imperial impact on South Africa, because that's the period I researched. The period before that is very relevant. I don't think human wrongdoing started in 1652 or something like that. What I have studied about before the arrival of European Christians here is the goodness that was here beforehand. And there's some seldom known stories of an indigenous goodness of a noble and beautiful kind towards who? Towards the invader. That were edited out of our history books, never told in the time. But I'm not going that far because it's not my period of research. So just 300 years. We have 300 years of what I'd like to call conservative Christian religious and political hegemony. Hegemony means control, domination. Certainly political. Everyone who was in power in this country for those centuries came out of the white community with very, very few exceptions. That's none. Was orientated or was personally Christian. And similarly, Christianity, until really recently, was dominated racially in that way as well. And only in the last 5 centuries that began to change. An enormously long history of a very narrow section of, and no one culture sees it all. I wish Europe, where my forebears came from, had had the wisdom of that East African Swahili proverb which says, he who never, sorry about the gender thing here, he who never travels thinks his mother is the only good cook. But they didn't. So we had this little cocoon, believing itself to be in possession of the superior, and perhaps only truth, increasingly influenced everything. And 300 years of power means you influence everything. Schools, broadcasting, cemeteries, politics, everything gets influenced. And if the influence is morally bad, as it was, fundamentally so, there were goods, but the fundamental thing in my judgment was bad, then you really do poison the well all over the shop. And we have to reckon on the terrible heritage of that now happening. And it accelerated into terrible brutality in the declining years of white control. Whole generations of people exposed to appalling violence as small children, etc. Now, those 300 years did, I think, a lot of damage to parts of our Christian churches, including parts that I was once part of, through their history of guilt of association. With that, I think James Cochrane, professor at UCT, in his talk of Servants of Power, is a great favor by saying that the Anglicans and Methodists and other English-speaking Christians were just as happy in bed with power when before the Nationalist Party came to power in 48 years afterwards. Mm. Beginning in 1948, it did a lot of damage to the moral credibility of those faiths. I remember one of my background said to me, everybody knows from young people, the townships don't care anymore about Christianity. I think that has reduced now somewhat. It was there. But it didn't stop in 1996 with the new constitution, and I want to stick my head out now, despite having had a small role in the process of the new constitution, I think we actually do have an effective constitution. The official praise singers of our country say we have the most wonderful constitution in the world. Well, maybe we do. Does that make it the best that we have? No, it doesn't. Its moral basis is too small. The three values that govern our Bill of Rights are freedom, dignity, and equality. They are important. It's important that constitutional lawyers tell us that dignity and equality are more important than freedom, they're right. But that is not enough as a fundamental statement of values. What about truthfulness? What about kindness? What about all the other things that the religious would tell us are need to be there? And then secondly, we have a Bill of Rights which is having the unintended consequence under democracy in South Africa of fostering selfishness. A lot of us think that if you want a one-line definition of living, it is living unselfishly. So anything that encourages the view that me and my interests are all very important is working against it. So we have a constitution, a Bill of Rights that so emphasizes individual responsibility that I'm hearing now from middle-aged black South African parents that the real problem in South Africa is the constitution, that their children are only interested in their rights. They're only interested in their rights. And when some of us have tried to work with law to bring a parallel charter of moral responsibilities in, it sounds like a story. And so that just continues under democracy. Now, here are the conclusions I want to draw, and we still have about 10 minutes for some questions and discussion. I'm sorry, I'll carry this a little bit, but we started after the hour. And I'd love to have more time, but I know we're getting us on to get on to the 5:15 session. So, there might be conclusions. Please. Number one, the real culprits are conservative churches, to a lesser extent, the so-called liberal ones, which I think have completely failed to communicate the whole superb revolution in the interpretation of scripture to the ordinary people out there, greedy and corrupt politicians and citizens. I do quite a lot of work in relation to the business world, but you need a deep worry there too, and we all know what lies behind the global meltdown. Bigoted educators, what do I mean by that? I mean school principals in my province who, in violation of the law and the constitution, are beginning the school week with Christian devotions despite half the kids being of Indian background and Muslim and Hindu, African tradition and so on. In other words, their faith does not count as much as I call that bigoted education. And then morally complacent politicians who think our constitutions are cast in stone. Never war is the most wonderful thing anybody ever came up with. The other bottom line, they don't prove it. Bottom line of my statement, moral goodness, without which none of us can lastingly achieve the well-being that we want. It's far too important to be left to pastors and politicians. Thanks. That's as far as I'll go. We have 10 minutes or so for any questions.
Thank you for listening in to this lecture by Professor Martin Przeski. As I mentioned at the beginning, you are welcome to drop me a line with any comments you may have. My email address is digitaldion, Dion with an I, digitaldion@gmail.com. And I'd love to receive some comments and feedback and your thoughts on this lecture. And just to ask again, if you do make use of the lecture, please could you remember to reference Professor Martin Przeski. This lecture was delivered on the 22nd of June 2009 at the Joint Conference for Academic Societies in Religion and Theology at the University of Stellenbosch. And if you could also just make reference to my website, www.spirituality.org.za. Well, thanks for listening in, and have a great day. Goodbye.